We have many fans who read the book or have children read it with supervision, I would hope, because many of the stories of the Bible and many of the stories we illustrate are fairly graphic and fairly not child-friendly. So the actual full title of the book is obviously kind of a parody, The Awkward Moments Not Found in Your Average Children's Bible. So it's not for kids.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, to be spiritual or not to be spiritual? That is the question. Awkward moments in the Bible. And a near-death experience of the secular kind. All coming up next. Hello and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I want to kick off this week's episode with an email that came from one of our listeners about last week's email. If you recall, we were talking about spirituality and what it means to be spiritual. And here's Michael's email. I'll paraphrase some of it. I very much enjoyed your podcast. Regarding your latest show, I'm definitely one of those atheists who dislikes, and that might be too mild a term, the word spiritual or spirituality. He wrote a blog post about it, and in it he explains that there is no evidence for anything supernatural, including the idea that a human has a spirit. Since humans are nothing more than bodies with brains, there is literally no such thing as anything spiritual. As I wrote, I think words do matter, and using that term spirituality is a poor choice of words. Of course, we do connect with the rest of humanity and other life on the planet, and we do stand in awe of the vast universe. But please, let's not call that spirituality! Exclamation point. There is truly nothing spiritual about anything, including humans. Well, I would say that represents probably about half of humanists and atheists when they come across the term spiritual. They kind of feel the same way. And there's the other half who really don't care. The one thing that I would comment is the power of words and the power that we give words. For example, Thursday comes from the word Thor's Day, the god, the Viking god Thor. And we don't really believe that's Thor's Day, and neither do Christians, but we still use it because over time we kind of redefined it. So do we want to give theists a monopoly on the word spiritual, or do we want to kind of redefine the word and throw in our two cents and explain what spirituality means to a humanist? So therefore, when people hear the word spiritual, we could identify with them using that same terminology. Just something to think about. All right, well, let's get on with our interview. And we're speaking today with Mr. Horace Gilgamesh. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing great. You know, I understand that Horace Gilgamesh is a pseudonym. It's not your real name. But why don't you just give yourself a cool title since you're making stuff up, like Captain Horace Gilgamesh, or maybe even General instead of Mr. What do you think about that?
Well, actually, I'm now Reverend Minister Horace Gilgamesh. I spent the $35 through, I think it was Life Church, to get my ministry credentials under my pseudonym so I can perform weddings. Because, you know, it must be credible if you can get, you know, a minister credential for $39.95 online.
My sister spent $2.
Oh, I overpaid.
So you got ripped. But
well, I do have a doctorate in ministry now. So, you know, maybe we can go out to... We can get in a pissing match later over who has better credentials.
All right, fair enough. So we're going to be talking about your book or your series of books, The Awkward Moments Bible. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the books themselves?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the project originally started as an online kind of inside joke among many of my friends back, you know, colleagues from my days in ministry, as well as atheists, everyone from PhDs to soccer moms and everything in between. It started as a conversation over coffee and beer at the same time one evening. We were just having a conversation about some of the latest studies that came out showing how more than 50% of self-professing Christians couldn't even name the four Gospels, the first four books of the New Testament, the very foundations of Christianity, and how just insane, for lack of a better term, that seemed. And again, this was a table surrounded by both Christians and non-believers alike. But just the idea that in a world where you have people like Franklin Graham or Christian leaders telling people that they should be willing to martyr themselves for their faith, but they can't even name the first four books of the foundations of that faith. It seems pretty incongruous. So we got together and started really just kind of putting together, a really good friend of mine and I put together some illustrations, really meant for a Christian audience, but again, as an inside joke, more just to challenge people with their understanding of the Bible and biblical literacy, to kind of look beyond what is taught and told on an average Sunday when they open their Bibles, you know, once a week, if that. So, yeah, it's an inside joke. But again, it's more for Christians originally. I mean, there's a Christian audience that we had been most interested in, and then that grew, obviously, when the atheists and secularists came in and ruined the entire project by coming in and having a lot of conversations online, and started kind of the books really came as a result of a wonderful fan base that demanded some kind of print material that went along with the online side of things. So we wrote a book.
Cool. So this book is geared towards adults, or is it geared towards children or anybody?
Absolutely not for children. We have many fans who read the book or have children read it, with supervision, I would hope, because many of the stories of the Bible and many of the stories we illustrate are fairly graphic and fairly not child-friendly. So the actual full title of the book is obviously kind of a parody, The Awkward Moments Not Found in Your Average Children's Bible. So it's not for kids.
So are any of those moments found in the real Bible?
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, we try to go after the lesser known stories or the stories that are conveniently unpicked by your average Sunday going church crowd, stories you're not going to find pastors speaking about, even though for the most part, anybody who's been through seminary or anybody who's really studied the Bible will find these stories, and they're actual stories, actual verses, actual phrases and passages from the Bible. And we don't try to take anything out of context. A lot of times our illustrations are shared, for lack of being an apologist, out of context from the intent with which we use them. Like in the books, as well as like our online blogs and things, we always try to have a commentary that presents the social or historical or biblical history context of how those passages came to be and what the context was back in the biblical times, let alone how they're being used today in society.
Okay. So we know that children don't read your book or aren't supposed to, but how about Christians? Do you have a lot of Christians who read the book, or is it atheists? I mean, who is the book for?
Yeah, you know, honestly, we have a fairly diverse audience. I mean, even in the second book, the foreword was written by a prominent evangelical minister, author, and professor, Dan Kimball. So we have Christian fans. We have non-Christian fans. I'd say the biggest accusations aren't really about our understanding even of the Bible as much as it is kind of the, well, if you don't believe anymore, why do you even have a right to question or challenge or illustrate the Bible? It's the don't talk bad about my mom is cooking, only I can kind of thing. And so I think our biggest, when we have, for lack of a better term, conflict with audiences, it usually has to do more with Christian culture than it has to do with the Bible. So like if we, in our commentary, relate an old Bible passage to a modern-day challenge or problem, whether it be women's rights or faith healing, things like that, that's when the hackles go up in the believer community and the Christian community. More, again, not out of anger about us talking about the Bible, but out of frustration or concern over anybody questioning their actual practices and traditions when it comes to their religion.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about you for a moment. I understand that you were a very active Christian. Can you tell us a little bit more about that time in your life?
Yeah, sure. So I was raised in kind of a lapsed Catholic household. I did went through the sacraments of confession and communion and baptism, obviously, and the joys of circumcision. But I didn't really become a Christian, so to speak, until college at a very emotional conversion experience at a very emotional kind of what I call emotional blackmail rally that was destined for college students to bring them to the Lord. So I became a Christian in college, and then shortly after that, and kind of getting into the workforce world, I decided to follow a life of full-time ministry and became a leader of a fairly prominent international evangelism ministry, and did that for the better part of a decade before things kind of started to crumble. It wasn't an overnight experience. I didn't leave the ministry because of a lack of faith. It wasn't until really 3 or 4 years later that organically I really started questioning my faith and my background in faith and the Bible specifically, and really kind of researching things on my own outside of the vacuum that is sometimes created when you only get, you know, the picking and choosing, if you will, of the Bible that you learn in Sunday school or on Sunday with a pastor, or even in seminary for that matter. So, yeah, I mean, I was very involved, everything from international evangelism to right here in the United States with domestic evangelism, you know, for lack of a better term, targeting teens and youth, and using media evangelism online as well. So, yeah, 10 years of that. Plus many years, in church, playing in praise and worship bands and leadership in church, that kind of thing. So I've definitely seen both sides of that equation.
So normally you'd probably get a lot of, well, you know, you weren't a true Christian. If you're not right now, then obviously you weren't before. And of course, when I say obviously, I'm just quoting what some people may say, using the true Christian, no true Christian fallacy. But you were up to your head in Christianity. I don't think anybody could say that about you, but I take it they probably still do, don't they?
Well, I mean, they still do. I mean, obviously, actually kind of as an aside, we're actually writing a book, a non-illustrated kind of memoir, if you will, about using conversations between Christians and non-Christians alike with myself over the last couple of years, about 150 vignettes to specifically kind of talk about it. And the actual book is called No True Christian. It'll be out this summer, because one of the most common, as you said, there, one of the most common arguments is, well, you were never a true Christian. Right. Or the opposite side of that is, frankly, many Christians would say, well, you're still a Christian because once you confess, you can never go back and you can't unconfess that you believe in Jesus, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a challenge. And the same thing could be true, said about almost any practicing Christian right now with so many denominations or sects of Christianity. Any church can look across the street to another church that they disagree with and claim that pastor or any of the parishioners are, quote, not a true Christian. So that problem doesn't end with me.
Yeah, that's a problem. So obviously through this course, when you were knee deep into it in college, when you had this experience, you had this very emotional experience and you became a Christian and you spent 10 plus years knee deep in Christianity. I think you said like the last few years you started to have a lot of this internal struggle and conflict. What was it that made you pull the trigger? I'm not asking the typical question, what was it that changed your mind and you became an atheist? Because I know that that's too difficult for almost everybody to actually pinpoint. But I want to know, what was it that allowed you to get out of that lifestyle and decide and take that big risk and say, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore? And as you know, there's organizations out there to help ministers and people who just don't believe anymore, but they're stuck. They're in this lifestyle, and they had all this training and their careers and their families. Everything is based on this lifestyle. And how did you manage to jump over to the other side? Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Horace Gilgamesh about his book series, The Awkward Moments Bible.
It's an interesting way of asking that, Bo. I mean, I think I'll kind of back up to say probably a genesis of my starting to just doubt Christianity or question my own faith was what many Christians would call a life-changing experience, but in the opposite direction. I was in a horrible accident, many serious injuries, very near death, didn't see a white light, didn't see myself, you know, rising. Instead, as I was kind of drifting off, I was kind of giving up on living in the darkness, and I was blinded for a period of time. And I actually remember, I'll say, and I've kind of said, I've talked to the story in more depth, speeches and things, but as I was kind of drifting off, all of a sudden what brought me back to life was realizing, holy crap, I don't want to go to heaven. I don't want to spend the rest of eternity bowing on a knee to this capricious, malicious God. And it really did just like broke me. Like, why would anybody possibly ever look forward to that kind of eternity? Eternity, I mean, never ending. Bowing. But then realistically, I mean, I think if it wasn't for the fact that I got out of full-time ministry, I was able to take a few steps away and kind of look back on specifically how ministry is done, the marketing, the salesmanship of Christianity, and then reflect on how, unlike my walk away from faith, which was fairly organic, fairly personal, fairly introspective, fairly not subjective to outside, you know, views, opinions, and kind of rhetoric, my walk into Christianity was very much constructed, manipulative, and coerced by everything from child evangelism ministers to, you know, other ministries using things like the Engel scale to other ministries using, you know, lights and music and cheap theatrics to get people to feel guilty that Jesus Christ died on the cross for them, and that blood that sprays all over the stage is because of you, so you must, you know, it's seeing that from the inside, from somebody who's doing ministry and figuring out the best ways to quote-unquote reach the next generation by using, frankly, like I said, theatrical tactics and manipulation to get people to convert to Christ and become new customers of Christianity, for lack of consumers. Seeing that from the outside, it was a big experience for me, and that was more of a turning point than anything else. You know, that obviously comes up, the why did you lose your faith? And
right.
At the end of the day, I don't think I lost
anything. You gained reason, my friend.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have often referred to myself as a happy heretic who was once saved by grace before being redeemed by reason. And that's what it comes down to. And I think, you know, I had a friend who actually framed a big feather off of a peacock that he wanted me to put on my mantle, which I have in my office. But he refers to it as my magic feather of faith, and he kind of patted me on the back to say, see, you don't need this anymore. You know, a secular friend who was always my friend, even in my deepest hours of Christianity, I thought that was kind of a beautiful way of looking at that. The magic feather that people look to, the placebo, the answer to answer the fears that we all have on a daily basis about what is the meaning of life, what happens when I die. Sometimes it's okay just to say, we don't need the magic feather anymore.
Yeah, that's some good points. It's interesting, this language that's used within religion and within the secular community as well. Generally, it embraces this idea of framing. When you frame something in terms of a loss, it makes it more negative, as opposed to framing something in terms of gain. For example, some of the language that Christians might use is abandon faith, lose religion, found Jesus, reject God. What we need to do in the secular community is embrace this idea of framing as well, and not use the Christian language, but use language that really favors our ideas. Like, we progressed spiritually past the need for a religious framework. We found reason. We embrace critical thinking. That's the kind of language we need to be using.
The more we look at, like I say, we, Agnes and I, kind of look at different Bible passages, the more you see influences and evidence of, just like you said, that. I mean, even starting with the Pentateuch and the Old Testament, the ideas of, you know, verses like Psalms, we just illustrated this week, but ideas like Psalms, I think it's 14:1, talking about only fools believe there is no God, their actions are corrupt and evil, abominable deeds, none of them can do anything good, not one of them. Well, that's a pretty convenient bunch of condescension. I mean, if you have your own religion, wouldn't it be great if the book, your holy text, refers to anyone who believes differently to be nothing but a fool, and an evil fool at that? So yeah. I think the marketing is only getting better throughout the centuries, but at the same time, so is the skepticism that goes along against that.
Yeah, of course. And also, if you're putting out a book about a religion, you want to write somewhere in the book that everything in this book is completely true and written by God.
And we've only seen that a few times. But the same, you know, at the same time, like the marketing kind of thing, we've been talking about that internally and have kind of started a mock partnership, or a kind of a casual partnership with some other friends. That takes a look specifically, and it's basically the initiative or movement. I mean, it's nothing really yet at this point, but it's really putting together a series of actions to help religious organizations be held accountable for the stories they tell and the promises they make in order to bring on new converts or new members to their church and things. So the whole idea, you know, the psychic hotlines or the palm readers of the day, they're all pretty well legislated and regulated against that. You know, at the bottom of the TV screen, it says, you know, for entertainment purposes only.
Right. Yeah.
But then you go to church on a Sunday because you're invited by a friend, and a pastor's up there telling you about how this man 2,000 years ago died because of your sins, and all you have to do is believe in him, and then, of course, thereby become a member of the church who gives us 10% tithe every week and all that kind of stuff. But if you do all these good things, then you're going to have eternal life. Well, prove it. It's kind of our point in that conversation, like, especially when it comes specifically to children's ministries, things like Child Evangelism Fellowship and the Good News Clubs that are in public schools kind of all over the country nowadays, kind of turning trusted school teachers by day into essentially religious clerics once the bell rings, and turning classrooms into madrasas. The idea of, you know, teachers, again, trusted all throughout the day, telling children what are the seven most important things in the world, and they are that Jesus died and he died for you, and that you're a sinner, and that you're saved if you believe in Jesus, and you get to live forever, and you get to live for God. These things, again, says who? And if you can't prove it, why is there no oversight? Because it is a financial transaction. At the end of the day, religion is a financial transaction. There is a sale happening. There is marketing happening. There's a huge, huge market of competition between ministries, especially evangelism ministries, let alone the average church. You know, if there are 30 churches in a town, they're all advertising and competing for consumers and customers to help them pay their bills. But when it comes to evangelism ministries, like I used to be in, I mean, it was always the kind of joke that wasn't even that much of a hidden joke or an inside joke, but the ideas of dollars for souls, things like spiritual return on investment, were being sold to donors, that the more you give, the more you'll save, and the more, you know, the better you're going to feel for yourself because you're saving people from what? And without any kind of actual proof or indication, I mean, if it's so true, show me one person who's living forever and we can start having a conversation. But until then, I do think that there's a fine line between religious freedoms and freedom of speech. The idea that when somebody is already in a religion, by all means, they should have the opportunity to worship freely within their own religion. There shouldn't be government insight into that, things like that. But when it comes to the marketing of religion, when religious organizations are going out to find new recruits, those recruits are not of that religion yet. So I do think that there's kind of a case to be made that if you are advertising for new consumers, just like any other consumer protection, whether it's cigarettes or herbal supplements, you do have to kind of put your money where your mouth is and show some proof for the claims you're making in order to get those new recruits.
Right, right. But I think religion is different because they're actually selling unfalsifiable claims, and that's the problem. For example, there's no way they could prove that heaven exists or hell exists, the, you know, the big benefits and the big carrot and the big stick of many religions. But that's why they also sell this concept of faith along with the religion. I really do think it's a package deal.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, absolutely good points. This all still, for me, comes back to fear. The more and more I think about this and try and deconstruct this, the more I really look at religion as being essentially a manufactured anecdote, or at least placebo, to the very fears that once plagued our, you know, tribal Bedouins and still plague us today. And that's the idea. You know, there's some things that we've been able to be explain through unfalsifiable evidence, things like earthquakes and volcanoes and hurricanes, and we understand these things nowadays. Yep. But imagine yourself back 2,000-5,000 years ago, before we had any understanding of the plate tectonics, before we had any understanding of magma and the Earth's core and pressure and those kind of things. So when a volcano erupts, clearly there are demonic forces underneath the Earth's surface that are trying to what? It's about me at that point. It's the narcissism. I mean, the only thing that really, really separates us as humans, Homo sapiens, from all the other animals out there is this idea of fear. Not fear of being beaten by your master like a dog might have, but the fear of tomorrow. And that's where I think a lot of this religion comes in, from that sense of fear. What's going to happen to me when I die? Why is the sky opening up with rain to help my plants grow? Well, it's because of me and something good I did, and the gods are smiling upon me. Why is the earth quaking? Well, it's because of something somebody did that's bad, so the gods are punishing us with terror. And when you're trying to form a philosophy of life in a vacuum of ignorance or misinformation, it's pretty easy to hold on to these fears, because then you bring up the greatest fear of all: death. What is the fear of death? Well, a child asks his father or his mother, what happens when I die, like grandpa who I just saw die five weeks ago? Well, you can't lie and say you live forever here on Earth, because that child has seen that grandma is no longer existing here on Earth. It's pretty easy to say, well, we live forever.
Yeah.
Prove otherwise. And that's when I get back to that full circle about, well, they didn't have to prove it 5,000 years ago. They don't have to prove it today. Because at the end of the day, what everybody's hoping for is a placebo, is an anecdote to those fears. I should say it's completely natural. This is the caveat here. It's completely natural. We lie to ourselves every day, whether it's about that health food that actually isn't healthy, or whether it's the skinny jeans that nobody should be wearing, all these things. We lie to ourselves about our political candidates. We lie to ourselves about why a movie won the Oscar and the other one didn't. I mean, we have these constructs to help us make it through the day, and it's completely natural. The danger is when you look at these fears, and like you said, people believe them, like these religions, very, very seriously. It's not that they think that their pastors are lying to them. As you continue to be indoctrinated, as you continue to hold on to these fears, if somebody, or these anecdotes rather, when somebody questions the anecdote to the fear of death, people are going to fight. Just like if I were to tell somebody that muffin they're eating is only going to give them a bigger muffin top on the top of their jeans, somebody's going to fight with me, and rightfully so, because they're being attacked or they're being questioned. The lies they've been telling themselves are being challenged. And the same, so you take that from a conversation about jeans to a conversation about eternal life, and now we have a real fight, because it's not just about what I'm wearing, it's about who I am, and it's about that anecdote that I hold so closely to my heart that's going to keep me from fear in my final days.
Sure, sure. Well, we see a lot of these kind of issues. Eternal life is one of the big ones, obviously, but also we can look at, say, gender issues. When you look at the Bible, there are certainly a lot of areas in the Bible that have something to say about gender issues, and generally it is men are superior and women are inferior. What is your view on that? I assume that creating the Awkward Bible, you found a lot of those in there, and you probably have spoken about that as you go around speaking to these different organizations. So what are your views on the gender issues present in the Bible?
This last month, I had an opportunity to speak a couple times out in the Carolinas, Charleston and Raleigh, and I started my whole conversation off kind of joking, using the Apostle Paul's words in 1 Corinthians and 1 Timothy, because both of the people who introduced me were women, mm-hmm. and wonderful women who I absolutely appreciate. But I kind of joked with the audience saying, hey, you guys do things a little differently around here, because where I'm from, women still aren't allowed to speak in church, thanks to the words of the Apostle Paul, that they should be submissive and silent in church. And why does that matter to me? I mean, this is, again, faith-based, because for the first, 135, 140 years of this great democracy of the United States of America, over half of the population wasn't even allowed to vote.
Yeah.
And that wasn't born in a vacuum. The same thing with, obviously, things when it comes to issues, if we're talking about issues, I mean, obviously, things like marriage equality, is a large issue. It's kind of the civil rights issue of the 21st century now. And most of the proponents in that world are going to be based on religion and ignorance, not based on reality and logic. And that's not to point fingers and say that people with religious, like deeply held religious beliefs, are stupid. But it is to say, I guess if I had to sum it up in a nutshell, why I have problems with faiths or religions overall is that I think there's a pretty clear-cut historical record of religion getting in the way and impeding the progress of society. And as religion continues to kind of water themselves down more and more to fall into line and eventually catch up with the progress of society, it gets more and more difficult to kind of actually see the lines or see the inherent harms or impediments that religion brings. So things like, obviously, nowadays most churches allow women to speak in church. Mm-hmm. There are, however, very many who do not. I like when I spoke, I read quotes from James Scott, one of the kind of writers for the Greek, or sorry, not the Greek, but the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Not a huge denomination, but also not fringe. I mean, they have tens and tens of thousands of worshipers in the United States. But he goes on to make the point, as many would, that just because women are allowed to speak in church, that doesn't mean that society is right. It means that we are wrong and that we are, you know, going against the word of God. So yeah. Obviously there's a denomination that doesn't allow that. So again, it kind of goes back to impediments for me.
Yeah.
For me, I'll kind of rant, just go on another rant here. I mean, my biggest knee-jerk kind of hot button issue really has to do with children when it comes to religion, indoctrination of children, specifically when it comes to things like the Good News Clubs, when it comes to church camps that people drop their children off at in the summer, that the kids aren't even necessarily religious and haven't even been to church maybe, but they're dropped off at a charismatic or even Pentecostal church camp. Again, they're used to being told throughout their life that they are to be respectful to any authority figure, an adult authority. So they get dropped off at a church camp. They're old enough now to be left away from home probably for the first time. They're 6, 7, 8 years old. They spend an entire day with new people, learning new things, new children, new adults, new stories, new teachings that they've never thought about or heard before. And at the end of the day, they're surrounded by 4, 5, 6, 7 adults that are raising their hands physically for them. They're praying behind them. They're all crying out to God with a video camera shoved in their face and being told, coerced by adult authority figures to call out for Jesus. That, for me, is a problem. And I should say that's, you know, going back to our earlier conversation, it's when I bring up these conversations about the coercion of children in religion, that's when I really get the kickback from many in the Christian community. And I will say, in all honesty, many Christians would find that behavior absolutely abhorrent and disgusting and dangerous. But there are people, especially the fundamentalist community, who, you know, see no harm in that, and they see the child's crying tears as he's being restrained physically as being some kind of movement of the Holy Spirit, not because the kid is literally urinating himself because he can't get away from all these adults and he can't wait till his mom picks him up.
Mm. Yeah. Well, what you're describing sounds to me more like the systemic problem within Christianity itself, and that's the whole idea that if you really do believe that we are all going to hell and we're going to burn forever and suffer forever unless we accept Jesus, then it's sort of similar to the whole idea of pious fraud, where it's bad if you bring a six-year-old into a room and really brainwash them and make them cry and drill them down. But hey, at the end of the day, as long as he accepts Jesus, then he's going to be with Jesus forever and he's going to be happy for eternity. So the cost is so tiny and negligible compared to what the kid would have suffered, his fate, given that framework within Christianity. Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Horace Gilgamesh about his book series, The Awkward Moments Bible.
Well, I don't even argue. I mean, so somebody accepts Jesus on Friday. On Saturday, you know, in order to essentially prove that they are now a true new Christian, they're looking for ways to prove that. And whether that's through song or whether that's through sharing memes. I mean, one of the most popular Facebook pages right now is still Jesus Daily, Dr. Aaron Tabor's page, which I will say has gotten better. I would say partly because of, you know, our 100,000 fans of ours kind of pegging that site to call it what it is and the ideas of tragedy porn. But so what I was going with that is, so it's one thing if a child one day is saying, okay, I love Jesus, I accept Jesus, because his hands are being raised in the air and he's surrounded by, you know, adults with video cameras. But then the next day, the next step of that is to then share memes and internalize phrases like Jesus Daily always posts the phrase, I am nothing without Jesus. I am nothing. Without Jesus, I am nothing. And there are only so many times you can say something like that before you really, truly start to believe it. It's one thing to be pious and have the idea of, I'm giving everything to God because without God, there is nothing. But then there is the self-loathing, guilty, very real, depressing sense of self-loathing, of I am nothing, I am worthless, I am broken, I am a sinner, I am weak, I deserve hell. That there's some danger. I don't care if you're 6 years old, you're 6 years old, or if you're a 45-year-old with 3 children. When you have that kind of ideology, it can be quite dangerous. I can think of nothing more deplorable, more damaging psychologically to tell a child than they are nothing. without Jesus or without a parent, I don't care. But to say you are nothing, well, frankly, I think that's where I kind of draw the line and start to get my hackles up, and I'm not afraid to shout back.
Yeah, and I've heard some different, I guess, excuses maybe for that, or justifications, attempts at justifications. One of them being that, well, we are nothing, and it's just the truth. So if you want to sugarcoat it and say that we're not all flawed and we're not inherently evil, then go ahead and do it, but you're the one who's lying. And that kind of pisses me off.
Well, I would say prove it at that point,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Like even the illustration we had to come out this week of the Psalm 14:1 with the, you know, those who only fools say there's no God and they're all evil and they can't do anything good. We illustrated that for the folks who are on the podcast here. We illustrated that with a very, very high horse up in the clouds that takes a ladder to get to the top of the horse, with a man sitting on top of the high horse with blinders on and earmuffs on so he can't hear, holding the Bible and shouting through a megaphone, as down far below in the valley, there's a graveyard that's filled with crosses as gravestones, but then there's one of Alan Turing, where there is a World War II veteran saluting Alan Turing's grave, as well as the, you know, spouse who is now able to, you know, be with her husband, who was probably saved by Alan Turing's, you know, one single man's contribution to the world by breaking the German Enigma and really ushering in the end of World War II and saving many countries from famine and bankruptcy, let alone maiming millions of lives. That's where some of this rhetoric has gotten so simplistic in the Christian world. And when we get the, you know, you see them in memes and you see them in comments on sections, like whether it's my page or Fox News, about how evil non-believers are, or how evil people of other beliefs are, it gets a little too simplistic. So we kind of wanted to give a nod to the reality that many people do good regardless of faith.
Yeah, they sure do. And the research supports that idea too. So any group that says that one group is evil or one group is inherently bad because of their beliefs or their lack of beliefs, well, they're just plain wrong about that. And with, of course, the exception of some crazy cults. But we're not talking about that. Now, another idea or question that's been circulating around the internet recently is this idea of people doing bad things because of their religion or even because of their lack of religion. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, and we've talked a few times over the last couple of years and put stories up on the blog, you know, about specifically mothers who kill or try to kill their children for religious reasons. And people have attacked us by saying, well, not all Christian mothers will kill their children, or they didn't do that because of the religion. And I would just say we go out of our way not to attribute such acts to people unless they specifically in their court documents or in their 911 calls say, I did this so my daughter could be with Jesus, or I killed my son so he wouldn't have to suffer life on earth. Now he can be in heaven. Like those kind of things. I mean, there is a separation there between obviously all Christians being evil who are going to kill their children and the ones who say I'm doing this because they're not. Well, the one thing they have in common is they're not all saying Daffy Duck told them to kill their children, or they're killing their children so they could be with Daffy Duck. They're doing it based on their religious understanding, their ideology, and sometimes even the calling that their pastors will give them the day before. So it's there's some danger there, obviously. I mean, at the end of the day, I would say, for lack of a better term, the good news is, like how we started this podcast, you know, at least 55% of Christians don't even know the names of the four Gospels, even less open their Bibles on a weekly basis. So we're talking about the fundamentalists at this point that we really have to be concerned with when it comes to that kind of violence. At the same time, though, and 98 or 99% of our current Congress has religiously affiliated beliefs. And if you like watched the latest congressional swearing in of John Boehner as Speaker of the House, you know, Nancy Pelosi didn't bat an eyelash when she grabbed the mic again before she walked off the stage to say, "And God bless America." And then John Boehner started his entire speech by quoting, "You know, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad." So there is this kind of separation. On one hand, you have the absolute, for lack of a better term, like you said, batshit crazy people who are willing to kill their children. Obviously, they're mentally unstable, they're mentally ill, and it just happens to manifest in religion because that's where they are. And at the same time, you have a Congress leading this country based on, frankly, religious beliefs. And I think for all intents and purposes, I try to recognize and remember that while the founding fathers might disagree, for all intents and purposes, we do live in a Christian country, which is why people like myself write under a pen name, which is why people like myself have to kind of hide when we get death threats. It is what it is.
Well, you know, when it comes to government and Congress especially, I'm always wondering how much of that is actually just due to pandering and how much of it is due to authentic evangelical beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, this is all speculation, obviously. I would say a great deal of it comes to pandering. When you look at the speechwriters and you look at who's in people's pockets and things like that. I mean, I think the reality is, with a very few exceptions, most politicians aren't idiots, right? So they can look at the demographics of their districts, and they can look at the demographics of America as a whole and see who's being voted and who's not being voted. I mean, the latest, I don't know if it was Pew or Barna, showing that the most unelectable person, even, you know, besides illegal immigrants or atheists at the bottom of that list. Right. So, you kind of have to have some sort of affiliation if you want to move forward. Yeah. It's where the money is. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the money.
Yeah, you sure do. And we definitely need more atheists or more secular people in Congress and Senate and in government in general. I think people don't even have to say that they're atheists. They don't have to use that title. I know many atheists would say, we should use that title. But just really focusing on secular government and keeping religion out of government, I think that's really important for our country in general, just to keep a secular perspective. As opposed to leaders and politicians who look towards the Bible to set policy.
Sure. Yeah.
And as you know, of course, there's a lot of awkward moments in the Bible, so that's probably not the best idea. And I do believe that a lot of theists would actually agree with the whole premise of a more secular government, but yet Christianity is so prevalent in our government. Why?
Well, I think at the same time, they're still being elected, right? I mean, it depends on where you are. I come from the great state of Washington state now, right? One of the most liberal in the country. At the same time, right across our borders in Idaho, you have state representative who's basically fighting against those that are trying to get rid of religious exemption laws that essentially protect parents who kill their children, for lack of a better term, under the guise of faith-based healing. So there are cemeteries filled essentially with children with some very specific denominational sects in Idaho that withhold medical treatment as simple as Tylenol to bring down fevers, and as a result, children are dying. So there are state representatives who are trying to close these loopholes that essentially parents can be tried with neglect for their children dying, specifically because instead of calling an ambulance, they call the elders to come pray over them. So then you have, you know, these elected officials who are then fighting against those, saying we should have all the right in the world that if we want our children to be with Jesus sooner, what's wrong with that? Yeah. Or in Tennessee right now, there's a senator or a state senator representative who's just initiated a bill in Tennessee to specifically include in the state constitution new language to say that we recognize that our, I'll say if it was sovereignty, but, you know, comes from the creator and savior of, you know, God, basically Jesus Christ, in a very Christian perspective. And this is 2015, especially now that we're, you know, fighting against essentially theocratic ideologies like ISIS out there. And at the same time, we can't really see beyond our noses that, yeah, it's right in front of us as well, just from a much less violent perspective. I mean, people always ask me, like, well, now that you've lost your faith or you don't have faith, what hope could you possibly have in this world? I'm like, whoa, hold on. All of my hope is in this world. I live for today because promise is no tomorrow. You know, there is no promise of tomorrow as far as I'm concerned. So we have to make every day the fulfilling, you know, carpe diem, whereas the opposite certainly isn't true, like you just intimated there. And that's one of the things that really gets me concerned is when you have folks like, I'll use his name again, Franklin Graham, going on national TV to say, well, absolutely, Christians should be willing to martyr themselves, not to go blow themselves up with, you know, suicide vests, but if somebody, Lord forbid, they get stuck in an ISIS stronghold because they're kidnapped when they're, you know, helping in Syria, and they're told that they can be freed if they renounce Jesus, Franklin Graham's answer is to say, no, if you're not willing to die for Jesus, then you are, you know, basically putting a stain on Christianity for everybody who's died before you. Yet you probably don't know a damn thing about your religion in the truest sense of the word. I mean, the idea, you know, Bart Ehrman, I really enjoyed Bart Ehrman's writings, and I saw him speak recently, and just talking about the fact that Jesus of today, of modern Christian interpretation, would certainly not recognize himself. it's changed and evolved, and you had intimated that as well. I mean, the Christianity has changed and evolved so much into cafeteria Christianity that I certainly don't believe that there's any such thing as monotheism. I mean, we have as many Christian gods and Christian Jesuses as we do believers.
Yeah.
I call it Christianity du jour. I mean, make it up how you want on a daily basis. Your views are going to change just as much, if not more, as the views of the church have changed throughout history.
Yeah, well, it's been said that everybody's personal Jesus is really just a reflection of their own personality, wants and biases. And
sure.
I think that's very true. And they do that, of course, within a range, but the range is pretty big. And especially if you're very flexible and creative with your biblical interpretation, that range could expand. And your Jesus could be anybody from like a MacGyver to a Mother Teresa.
Well, we all do that. I mean, to be honest, I mean, we obviously do that with our political candidates or our favorite musicians, and we try to, you know, if somebody gets in trouble, we try to justify it or somehow spin the story. But it gets a little different when that person has been dead for 2,000 years and you can speak for him. So that's kind of the other side to probably even finish up our conversation here. One of the things that we get hit with all the time, like you said, is the idea, well, that's not what Jesus really meant. Jesus really meant X, Y, Z. And I kind of say, well, this is no different, you know, that's no different than the Apostle Paul. I mean, Paul was the very first, the inaugural, what Jesus really meant to say, sales pitch man for Christianity. And nothing's changed for the millions of pastors over the last thousands of years. Yeah. So,
all right. Well, good stuff. Before we end, do you have your book handy? And if you do, can you read an excerpt from one of your books to us?
I just happen to have one here. So in the second book, we kind of took a more focused approach, but we still go back to the Old Testament for fun. One of the critiques people say without understanding our books is that, well, I always go after the Old Testament, which actually isn't true at all. We're pretty equal opportunity. But for today, I'll go back to the Old Testament. So we call this one 32 Virgins for the Lord. Out of Numbers, it says, "Why have you let the women live? They followed Balaam's advice and caused the people of Israel to rebel against the Lord at Mount Peor. You must kill them all, every man, woman, and child, except the young virgin girls. Keep the virgins for yourselves." Of course, if you know the rest of the story, that's all the virgins except for the 32 virgins that the Lord demanded for himself. So I just encourage your listeners to go look up Numbers chapter 31, verses 15 through 41.
Who is the speaker in that story?
It's actually God talking to Moses at that point.
God talking.
Well, it's actually Moses talking with his own. Moses just had a conversation with God and is instructing his army to basically finish the job that they started in order to keep God happy. And then God tells Moses then to take 16,000 for the fighters, and then he splits the other 16,000 up, and then but God needs to keep 32 virgins for himself. I just kind of wonder, with all this conversation about Muslims looking for their virgins in paradise, what exactly did the Christian God or the Abrahamic God want with 32 virgins for himself?
Well, that's why the Muslims keep on looking for him in paradise. So they can't find him because our God has them all.
Oh, I got you. Yeah. So real quick, just to end, I would say the second book, the first book is kind of a random smattering of things. The second book around, though, part of like the New Testament section was really kind of an answer to the mythicist movement in a lot of ways, where the mythicists, whether it's Robert Price or Earl Doherty or most recently, you know, Richard Carrier, the idea of Jesus never existing at all. Our reaction or our response would be to say, you know what, I'm not going to get in that fight, because regardless of whether or not he exists or you believe on this little bit of evidence or that little bit of evidence, the reality is that billions of people believe Jesus existed. So instead, we take a look at the actual scripture and the actual stories of the New Testament and Jesus' words, his own words. So we put together a narrative more in the second book to show, well, if he did exist, would this be a man that you would actually follow and give everything away to follow and emulate your life after? And I think we only chose 8 or 10 stories in the second book, but I think those together show a much more focused approach of, Jesus' own family referred to him as being insane. So who are we to know Jesus better than his own family? And I think that's a conversation worth having. So I'll just leave it with that. But I appreciate all the time you gave me today. I realize that went a little long as I usually do. So I appreciate it.
No, don't worry about it. It was great. It was a wonderful conversation. So why don't you just finish up by telling our listeners where they can find out more about you and about your book that you write and get a copy of the book.
Yeah, you can always find us, you know, online. Facebook is where we spend the most time conversing with believers and non-believers alike. Facebook.com/awkwardbible. We also have our blog, awkwardmomentsbible.com. Books are available. The Awkward Bible series is available on Amazon already. Books 1 and 2 are out. Books number 3 will be out this fall, as well as the book No True Christian, which is more of a kind of memoir told in the stories of many conversations I've had with believers, non-believers alike. So yeah, look forward to seeing y'all online.
All right. Awesome. Thanks so much for being with us.
Take care. Thanks, Bo. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. That was Horace Gilgamesh, author of Awkward Moments Bible. The illustrations in that book are just amazing. There's something about illustration that can make something so funny. It's just the way that it's drawn. There are some artists who just have that talent. I should have asked him exactly about the artist, but I don't know if he wants to give away the identity of the artist, if it's himself or what. But the art is just amazing in there. It reminds me of the old Dr. Katz episodes that I used to watch on Comedy Central. It just made everything he said so much more funny. It was a great show. Anyway, thank you for joining us. If you do have any feedback for this episode, we'd love to hear from you. Send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on the Humanist Hour. Bye-bye.